Welcome to the Better Together podcast, brought to you by the Emergency Services Foundation.
This is a podcast dedicated to supporting and improving the mental health and well-being of many people, paid and volunteer, who serve our community in emergency management roles.
My name is Susan McKenzie, CEO at the Emergency Services Foundation.
And I'm Shannon Hood, a clinical counsellor who specialises in working with emergency services personnel.
Today we're speaking with Steve Farina, a Vice President of the British Columbia, that's in Canada, Professional Firefighters Association. The reason we wanted to speak with Steve is because of his involvement with the British Columbia First Responder Resilience Program. And the reason I asked Shannon to join me is because he's a trauma counsellor who has worked with ESF in various training settings. And he's also a former emergency services volunteer with the South Australian SES. And I know that he's as excited as me about establishing a program similar to the Canadian one in Victoria. Great to have you both join us.
Thank you.
Thanks, Susan. Welcome, Steve.
Welcome. Yeah.
Yes, thank welcome. You. So we came across the program in Canada when we were gathering evidence for the residential wellbeing program ESF wants to establish here in Victoria. In fact, through Tony's Trek, which will take place later this year, that's exactly what we're raising funds for. So it feels like we are getting very much closer to our dream and our goal, which is, for me, incredibly exciting. So, Steve, can you please tell us, how did the First Responder Resilience Program come about?
Well, it started back in 2015, and we had two back-to-back suicides in a Surrey Fire Department, which is one of the bigger departments here in BC. And they were 7 weeks apart, and it shook us to the core of our organizations. In fact, right across the first responder family world. And we decided we needed to do something. We had to get upstream from this. And we took a real hard look at what was happening in our first responder world when it came to mental health, what the gaps were. And we surveyed our members, and we found there's a big gap in education, gap in, well, massive barriers and stigma, stoicism, and reaching out for help was not really prominent. And so we went down a path where we formed a task force, and we brought together people to create some solutions. And through that task force, in parallel, was the BC First Responder Committee came together as well. And that was police, fire, paramedics, union, and employer coming together to solve this problem. So we were both tackling this in parallel. But with my association, and some contacts that I had, I met a fellow by the name of Tony Spies through my fire world, and we had done some contract work together off the job. And he was ex-military, served in Bosnia, and was part of developing the Veterans Transition Program with two doctors by the name of Dr. David Kuhl and Dr. Duncan Shields. And that was back in 1997. And it was helping veterans transition back into civilian life. And so he had part in setting this up, and he said, we need to do this with firefighters. We have so many of our firefighter friends that are hurting right now and need to take a knee and need to learn some psychoeducation and share their stories in safe spaces. And so he's said, you have to meet this doctor. And so in a fire hall here in my neighborhood, I sat down with Dr. Duncan Shields and Tony, and he kind of went over what the program was about. And I said, we're doing this. We're going to do this here in BC. And I said, I'm going to get us some seed money from workers' comp. And I'm going to go grocery shopping. We're going to cook together. We're going to heal together. And we're going to have a circle of trust. And that's sort of the inception of it. We created this brainchild that we took that transition program. We interviewed 30 to 40 firefighters from rookie to retiree to find out what the challenges were, what the stories were, and we basically formed that program around that. And so it was informed by that trauma, those experiences, and then, you know, an amazing program was born.
Can I just say, you know, that resonates so much with me, because I know a couple of years ago in one in the Metropolitan Fire Brigade here in Melbourne, I think there was 3 suicides in a week.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, it just absolutely devastated everybody.
Yeah. The ripple effect of a suicide in our world is astronomical, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, we respond to suicides as first responders, but when it's one of our own, you know, you feel like you've let them down and you haven't seen them and heard them and helped them. So it's really hard. It was really hard. There's a lot of grief around that.
Yeah.
You talked about the first responder family, and I really resonate with that. That's same this side of the equator, Steve. So you talked a lot about the background to the story, the program. What's been in your involvement in the program since it's been running?
So it was a big part of my job was coordinating location, coordinating programs, getting funding. As I mentioned, I was grocery shopping for the first little bit, and now we've got a place that actually cooks food, and that's, we've taken that part out of it. We thought we'd replicate a fire hall setting where we're cooking together, eating together, but it was taking time away from our, not our treatment, but our program. So we moved to that. And so I was doing a lot of program coordinating. So because I guess mental health is my portfolio in BC, and I've got a bit of a public facing image where I'm the guy to contact if you're struggling in BC, I was getting phone calls from spouses and from members wanting to come through the program. It was literally word of mouth. We just advertised at our own conferences and our own conventions and educationals. And so I was taking names, creating programs, working with the clinicians. We actually started off with having team leads. So people had come through the program, wanted to come back, and were giving back. So they're more like a peer mentor kind of role, helping facilitate the group work. And we were finding that that was really hard on our peers. And we were kind of moving away from that model because the doctors were spending time, they were getting triggered actually, you know, hearing all the, everyone else's stories. And I mean, we're not trained as clinicians, right? So that was a big part of a big learning for us. And so I transitioned, I now have a program coordinator. So now I'm still taking names and still trying to raise funds, but it's more of a higher level. And back in 2018, I actually went through the program myself because I was needing to take a knee. So the doctors wanted me to go, 2019 I did that. And the doctors have been bugging me. And I finally had to take a knee myself. And it's funny because we do this in our world's like, I'm not that messed up. Someone else could use it more than I could. So I kept on putting myself down the queue until a point where I was like, holy shit, like I need to go through myself. And I wanted to see it. And so I could talk about it from a place of participation, right? And my Lord, everything that I heard testimonial, anecdotally, going through that, and I went through with 2 coworkers and a really good friend of mine that I was hired with, my Lord, it was transformational. Mm. Like it was profoundly transformational. So, And it's 4 days. It's not a 30-day in-treatment program, but the amount of heavy lifting and hugging and crying and grief processing, trauma processing, and life processing that happens in those 4 days is truly inspirational and provides a lot of hope and puts people on a trajectory of healing.
So you're talking about hugging and crying and talking. That's not what men do.
Oh, I know. It's so counterintuitive with our culture. I'm a hugger, so I'm known in my industry as a hugger. But when you have men together sharing and supporting each other, it was powerful. It was like a rugby scrum. It was you're coming together and you're supporting each other and propping each other up. My Lord, it was a powerful thing. And you could tell the people that aren't used to that kind of contact, but you feel safe there. There's something magical about having this shared and lived experience of doing the job that we do. And we all see the same stuff, police, fire, ambulance. We see horrible, horrible things. And we all share that experience. But when you are living it alone and you think you're alone in that trauma and you're trying to process it by yourself and you feel, when you have a group of people that acknowledge that and tell you how it impacts them, hearing your story, and it just validates all those feelings, you can't help but cry, hug, and bond. It's such a powerful bond that comes out of that program.
I'm getting teary even listening to you. So tell me, Just and before we get into more about what happens on the program, who gets to go on the program? How are they selected?
So it's, as I mentioned, it's word of mouth. So we have, I wouldn't say an extensive peer network here in BC, but a lot of the fire departments have peer teams, like a critical incident stress team or a peer support team. And so we have eyes in departments everywhere. And then we also have our union executive that have eyes on people. So when we see people struggling, we approach them candidly and say, I see you're struggling. I see you. We have this program. Are you interested? So that's the ask. Some people, it takes a year for them to build up the courage to be vulnerable and come out. And it takes great strength to put your foot forward, I think, and or put your hand up or take a knee. And so we recruit people that way. And then other people just reach out themselves through our website landing page, or just knowing, hearing my number or word of mouth. We do a lot of family nights and spouse nights. So we travel all over British Columbia with working with fire departments to educate them about psychoeducation and trauma and resources. And we have had spouses reach out and say, my husband's in a bad way, or my partner, my wife. And that's how we get them. It's all organically driven. So we're not actively seeking people, but we are, I guess, inadvertently saying, hey, we're here to help. And we've always filled our programs. I mean, we're not over capacity, but we are definitely, and we could run more if we wanted to, I'm sure. Just money. Money's the biggest barrier for us, really.
Yeah.
Mm. Yeah. I'm interested in understanding the program a little better. I've heard Duncan Shields speak about it, and I know you run it at a place called Lake Loom, and apparently what happens at Lake Loom stays at Lake Loom. But I'm wondering if you'd lift the lid a little bit for us and just tell us what happens.
Yeah, just the name itself. I mean, we candidly call it, it's Loon Lake up in Maple Ridge. So yeah, if you're going to Loon Lake, you're kind of loony. So it is a bit of an inside joke for sure. But yeah, that setting, we picked that setting because it's in the woods. It's a retreat away from civilization, noise. There's a special place of healing in nature. And we know being by water, being in the trees, there's a lot of, it's kind of like a Whistler-esque or log cabin-ish feel to it. You can put your feet into the grass and ground. It just has a special quality there. It's not like healing in a hospital or healing in a commercial building or industrial building or in a concrete jungle. You have to get into nature. That's our opinion. And as anecdotal from the folks that have gone through the program, it's like, it's a 7 kilometer drive up a gravel driveway. And so many people have said that you feel like you're departing, you're entering a different world, and you're leaving behind, you know, our firefighter world or our first responder world behind us. And it's not, it isn't a vacation. I can tell you that right now. It is some of the hardest work, and we work hard. First responders, we're not afraid of hard work, but this is some of the most mentally and physically draining work we've ever had to do. So you need to be in a setting where you can actually unplug, go for a walk, unwind. And that's a big part of our program, is that location piece.
Yeah. And so I can hear the location is really important. Can you give us some insight what actually happens on the 4 days without too many spoilers?
Oh, for sure. I'll walk you through my experience. So it's group work. So it's not an individual program. You come together. We all show up at 3 o'clock in the afternoon, and it's a get to know each other. And sometimes you'd be surprised how small our community is. It's, you might know somebody, you might not, but you're all brothers and sisters from another mother. There's a bond that happens immediately. You start getting to know each other. And it's a slow process, but so there's a bit of an intro. Then there's some ground rules. And it starts off with basically introductions. And you quickly, within 12 hours, you've got this bond. It's quite amazing. And that happens from program to program. We've put over 200 people through this program. And the same thing is a reoccurring theme here, is that you feel bonded quickly. You feel safe. The doctors are amazing facilitators. Duncan and David are wizards when it comes to making you feel comfortable, making you feel not judged. And so those are key elements of the program, is all of those things. So you're felt heard, listened to, and normalized, because we all know that the reactions and the trauma we have are not there. It's a normal response to abnormal events in our lives. And so you're taken through things like your proudest moment. And that could be in the fire service or in life. for me, it was my daughter being born, becoming a father. I get a clump when I think about that. And the new timeline. So what's really has been prevalent throughout the program as well is you timeline from your earliest memory until you become a first responder, and then your first responder time to present. And the really neat thing, or actually shocking thing, was the amount of adverse childhood trauma in first responders. It was actually humbling to hear those stories. And then they come into a helper profession to try and stop them from happening to other people.
And, wow, Steve, that's amazing. Do you want to know something? I've never heard that before. Have you, Shannon?
Yeah, unfortunately, yes. And part of it is often driven by the desire to do something corrective to fix what's happened. And sometimes there can be generations of first responders too. And part of the issue of the first responder back previous generations cascades from generation to generation. So some of these programs can, I'm excited by the idea of like stopping some of that generational transition as well. But yeah, go on, Steve. I'm loving the story.
Yeah, it is powerful. And it's interesting because that's where shame lies. And I think they bring this shame from their past. And then there's shame in, and we tackle things like the stereotype of being a firefighter, being a male in this society, and the pressures that are of a father, as of a husband, of a firefighter, and the social expectation of that, and the weight of that, of getting it right, being the rescuer, you know, fixing things, whether it's at home or at work. And there's a great deal of pressure when it comes to that. And you add on top of that this layer of onion of life and childhood and being married or having a partner. And then you throw the trauma on top of that, and an accumulation of 20 to 25 years of this, or even the first 2 years of your career, you could be a black cloud and see so much stuff within those first couple of years, that if you do not process that and unpack that with a professional like yourself, and, you know, downregulate and have all those great tools, we know that you're dumped with cortisol, you become hypervigilant, and that stoicism transitions from workplace to home. And it doesn't serve well at the dinner table when you're stoic and you're not sharing, and you start to wear it, and it starts to get very, very heavy. Mm-hmm. And so like that's the transformative part of this timelining, is to say, hey, and acknowledging there are light bulb moments throughout your life that impact you and have formed the way you are and how you handle and how you are resilient. And to be a firefighter, you have to be resilient. To be a first responder in general, to get the job, you have to be resilient. Sometimes it takes years, and then there's the training, and then the recruit process, and then just, you know, integrating into that world with that team can be very challenging. So we, you know, it's amazing the capacity of healing within us if you're given the right space and tools and direction. So that's a big part of the program.
So you talked about that getting to know each other as a team. That's the really fundamental thing for the success of the program and building that environment of trust. You've talked a little bit about sharing stories. So it's a four-day program. What happens on the other days? And what happens as you leave? What do you take with you?
Yeah, that's a great question. So the story time takes a while, because you've got eight people sharing their stories, and that can take a toll, and it does take time. You want to be very careful about opening up that wound typically. And so they are very delicate about that. And so you have that individual processing, the group processing, timelining, and you're doing some journaling throughout that. And then there's eating together and bonding. And then there is a psychoeducation component that takes up the rest of that. So there is parts of learning how to downregulate, learning about trauma, learning how to control your breathing, just understanding about how do you share, what's appropriate, what resources are out there. So that makes up the other days. So once you've done that timelining and heavy work and come together, then it's like, now how do we become more resilient after we've learned this, after we've shared this? So we're lessening the impact of that trauma. And this is, again, this is an upstream program. This isn't meant to do with someone that has full-blown PTSD or anxiety disorder or anything. This is understanding that you have trauma, acknowledging it, and how you become resilient and learn from that and grow from that, those experiences. And yeah, I guess the takeaway is we're trying to plant seeds in our culture. We're trying to take these people to go back into their organization and say, it's okay to share it. It's okay to take a knee. It's okay to seek help. And they're champions of mental health in their organizations. And we have some pretty stoic, pretty badass, you know, big burly mustache firemans and women going back into their organizations saying, hey, I went through that program. I went to Loon Lake. And they're seen as badasses. There's mental health badasses that they have the strength and they're vulnerable and they give people permission to do the same thing. And that's the crux of this, is we're changing the culture one person at a time.
It's interesting you use the term coming out, you know, and it is like coming out, isn't it? Because to be able to put your hand up to say, I need help, it is essentially a coming out.
Well, I tell you, there's two experiences. There's one fella I remember distinctly that it took him a year to build up the courage to ask for help. And his life at work, he was highly functional. He was a functioning firefighter, company officer, doing his job. No one knew anything different at work. At home, absolute disaster, because we know now that home is ground zero. That's when they see the changes in their partner, that, you know, you lose patience with your kid, you're snappy, like maybe you're got some maladaptive coping mechanisms like drinking and whatever. But you're at fine at work. Well, it took him a year because there's so much stigma around taking a knee and putting your hand up, especially as a senior person or a company officer. I guess it's just, there's so much stigma regardless. But if you're seen as weak in our job, there's a trust piece. And so it's amazing when you say coming out, because a fellow I was just on the call with this morning that went through our program, and I'm flying out to Manitoba in the end of May to talk about this program again. He said a call from 27 years ago took him out at the knees, 2 years on the job. And he only he reached out for help in 2018. And that's when we were a year into our program, and it took him that many years. And he lost a relationship with his wife, his daughter. Like, he was seen at work as a grumpy asshole. And I said, our job is to turn assholes into assets. Like, that's what we want to do. And we want to take you from surviving to thriving. And if we can do that with 4 days and then connect you to resources beyond that, I think that's critical to think about your well-being program, is it's a kickstart and it's a readiness program. And Dr. Duncan Shields talks about that, is it's getting them ready for treatment or additional healing. And I think and you have one chance as a mental health professional with first responders. In my experience, you have one chance, because you have stigma of this Sigmund Freud kind of lay on my couch and tell me about your mother. Like, we have this perception, right, of what a shrink does. You're going to shrink my brain? There's a trust piece here that we really are trying to break down that stigma on both sides of the fence. And I think that's critical. It's the readiness that, hey, mental health professionals aren't scary. They want to help. And trauma-informed people that have lived experience like you do, that's who we want to connect them to. And so there's a greater piece to this, is our first responder health network of clinicians that we've taught to be occupationally aware. And I spent 2 days with over 300 clinicians right across three provinces, myself and Matt Johnston. And there's another fellow that should talk about transforming fire culture. He's making massive inroads of building a team of people. And Matt's awesome. And so him and I've been working to build, you know, you have Loon Lake as a starting off point, and you need a hard handoff. And that's where the clinician network comes in. And then you need a supportive employer group where they understand graduate return to work. And so there's just so many pieces to this you got to start somewhere. And I think this is the place where we start.
The return to work is interesting. So how do people, they come out of this intensive 4 days, you know, where they're physically and mentally drained, no doubt, as well as encouraged and that, you know, how do they go back on shift?
Yeah, and that's a piece that we're still working the bugs out on. And we have, because I'm involved in the union world, that's who the referrals typically come through. So they know they're coming back into the organization. And so there's their hard handoff and there's eyes on the inside to keep an eye on them. And I do often reach out and check in. And we do a 3-month and 6-month follow-up with the participants. Mm-hmm. And I try and do that with the organizations as well and say, you know, is there anything else we can do? Do they need the workers' comp claim? Have we opened up Pandora's box where we actually need to get them more resources or them additional help? So that is a really integral piece of that, is making sure you have relationships. All the stakeholders are part of that program. So whether it's treatment, clinicians, having a clinician ahead of time prior to going through Loon Lake would be even better, or having someone lined up to help the process along, continue along, having a peer to hand them off to. Those are really that. I mean, those are great questions to ask participants to say, who's your person? Who's your safe person when you leave here that you are going to be supported by? And you, I think you mentioned having a family component. There needs to be, we do this in a different way here. We just ran for Langley City Fire Department, we just ran a spouse and family night with their department. They've got some very young people, so they know about the program. They're starting to understand like the challenges that we have as first responders and what that looks like at a family level. So there's not only the return to work, but there's also the return to family. And so these are critical elements of all of this.
And what did your partner think of you doing the program? And I guess partners more generally.
Well, you use my example. I'm probably the worst case scenario when it comes to, I have a couple of wives and I have a 15-year-old daughter. And I talked to her about that more because I think, because I didn't deal with my own stuff, I think that was the downfall of my relationships. And I'm learning that I have a lot of stuff that I still need to process and work through. And, but I asked my daughter and she's like, I think she appreciates my honesty. And when she saw me go through that program, she knew I needed to go through. I was in a very dark space in my life and we have a very good relationship. And she said, Dad, you're a different person. You're a different person. You have more patience now. You know, there's a softness there where I was very prickly. It was a porcupine going into that program. And I hear this from partners and I'll try to share the story without crying, but one fella that came through the program, we screened for suicide ideation and we look at that risk and firefighters, oh my God, they're so sneaky. They can hide their stuff so well. I'm totally fine. I'm good to go. No problem. He basically said 2 or 3 times driving up to Loon Lake, up that gravel road, he thought about basically driving off the road into a tree. He reached out. He went through that program and he reached out and his wife and him took me to lunch. You want to talk about impact to spouses. He said that you saved my life. He said that to me. And I told him, I just facilitated it. You did all the hard work. He did all the heavy lifting. And sitting at lunch with these two were all crying at the Cactus Club. It's a restaurant here. We're all crying at the lunch table. And I'm like, I felt so honored, like so honored to have been a small part of creating something that created that much change in 4 days. And I said, man, you are brave. You're brave for putting up your hand and saying you needed help. And I said to her, his spouse, I'm like, you are an amazing human to support him through such a challenging part of his life, right? Like they were at their wit's end. They were in a very dark place together as a couple. And yeah. And together he went back to work. He retired 2 years ago, happy as a clam. Like that's a massive testament to the work that happened in 4 days. And he did a lot of work after that as well, but that's just a little sample of
that's amazing. What goes on. Amazing. Yeah. Shannon.
I'm still recovering. Yeah. I mean, those kinds of testimonies are so powerful. And I think we work with people in their role as first responders, but as you called it, the ripple effect, the cascade to so many other parts of life that we can see improve when we can address some of these things. Thanks, Steve, for sharing. Really appreciate it. We're seeing some research at our end that some of the mental health issues in emergency services first responders have to do with like the workplace factors, workload, bullying, those kinds of things. Does any of that get tackled in the discussions, or is it just the critical incident stuff that you explore?
That isn't a great observation from your guys' end, because it's the same here. And we say it's organizational trauma. If you do not feel supported by your employer or by your organization, it actually seems to be worse than the traumatic calls, the critical incidents.
Yeah.
And so you feel there's a sense of, I'm not sure what the word is. It's almost like you've been left out to dry. You are completely a number. You're no longer a person. And I see this time and time again, where that overshadows the actual critical incident that put them over the edge. It's a fire chief that doesn't care, or doesn't understand mental health, or doesn't provide modified or light duties, helps with a graduated return, just puts up barriers, says, suck it up, buttercup. And until these dinosaurs die in those roles, we are not going to see change. But I am starting to see, and I have good friends are now in the fire chief roles, in the administrative roles, that are empathetic. They have an emotional IQ that is excellent. And so there is transformation happening. But yes, the bullying, 100%. And that's from the inside. So that's through recruit training. That's our culture that needs to change, where we put these extremely high expectations on new people coming in and expect them to move mountains and do everything we expect them to do, and not treat them like a human being. And that's one of the things that I've, now that I'm a company officer, I have zero tolerance for that shit. Like, I do not put up with that crap. You are part of my family. I care about what's going on in your world. We all have jobs to do. We're all professionals, and we're going to do that, but we're going to do that together. And if you're hurting, we're going to support you. And I'm not infallible. If I have a bad day, I'm going to tell you about it. And I think those gets permission for a very healthy culture. But yes, the organizational piece is amazingly challenging. And then people navigating the workers' compensation system, that's another piece that causes additional stress. And I'm working very closely with a lot of those folks. There's a lot of caring people in there, but an insurance corporation is an insurance corporation. And sometimes when it comes to psychological injuries, oh my Lord, they can do more harm than good sometimes. And that's another challenging piece.
What you're talking about is actually reflecting everything that came out of our answering the call research. You've hit the nail on the head with everything. One thing I'd like to ask you that just sort of dawned on me as we were sitting here, and I know you've said that this program is a kickstart, you know, for people, but there would be people here who would say, well, what's 4 days going to do, you know?
Yeah. And I think I already shared that. What 4 days did with that gentleman and his wife, if that's all we did, just that one couple, I close up shop and stop now. If we prevented one suicide from happening, or if we got one person back to work, 4 days, yes, it doesn't seem like a lot, but they are 10 to 12 hour days. They're the hardest thing that a first responder can do, other than go to inpatient treatment, I guess, with concurrent substance use and trauma. Like, this is meant to be upstream. Like, it's not the magic bullet, but my Lord, if you looked at our testimonial page, if you talk to the people that have come through that program, it is transformative, truly. And it is worth spending money on, raising money for. Like, and I love that Tony's raising money for it, because Tony was one of our four founders. Tony Spies was one of our four our fathers of our program. So that's kind of a cool name association there. But yes, it is worth it. And it's what the problem is, we haven't been doing anything. We have to do something. That was the one thing we found after those two suicides, that we need to do something. And Duncan says this beautifully, is like, nothing for us without us. If you don't build the program with us, we're tired of being sold a bill of goods from other people. We're tired of academia and treatment providers creating things for us without us. And that the trust that David and Duncan have built with the Men's Initiative and now the Blueprint, it's that you can't find that anywhere else. That trust allows them to be accepted into our world. It breaks down a barrier that exists between mental health professionals and first responders. And it's done in 4 days. And it is truly transformative. Like, there's just no other way to put it.
And you mentioned this briefly before, but the effect on the culture, you know, when somebody goes back into the workplace, tell us about that.
Well, it's what we found was the stoicism and the stigma around mental health was preventing people from reaching out. And so, as I mentioned, in parallel, that first responder committee, we created an anti-stigma campaign. So with our Loon Lake program, along with this anti-stigma campaign, is basically the slogan was share it, don't wear it. And so that's exactly what started to happening is there's some permission giving happening in organizations. So as we had people from all over BC come into our program and go back out into their organizations, it's these little fingers of hope started happening. And people were recognizing it at each other. There was a greater awareness of that, hey, we need to take a knee. And you start seeing it in other people. It's like, this guy's been grumpy for like the last 3 years. Maybe there is something going on here. And it started conversations, not just about sports and football and everything else. It was real conversations. And kind of, I think you had in Australia, you guys had a program with construction workers. It was like a mental health campaign, and it really resonated with us because we saw that and said, it's like bros taking care of bros. It's like having those tough conversations and not keeping it fluffy, getting real and having that. And I think that was the transformative piece, the culture change that happened at an organizational level. And then we brought leaders through it. We actually put 10 of our fire chiefs through one of our programs. And because we wanted to see the impact on themselves, and then so that they could support their people going out as well. So we're trying to tackle that a bunch of different ways.
Mm-hmm. And fingers of hope. I love that picture that you've painted there about, you know, the culture change. And I really resonated, Steve, to one of the things I love about the Emergency Services Foundation is really determined to do what you were talking about and not just sort of impose a program, but listen, learn, draw on the experience, work collaboratively as mental health professionals with frontline workers to build something that's going to work for all of us. So in that vein, what advice would you have for us? Susan has said to us, she is not going to retire until we get this program off the ground. And so we assume it's happening. So what advice would you have to help us get it happening?
Well, you hit the stakeholder piece perfectly. You need to involve everybody. You need to involve the union associations, the volunteer associations, the fire chiefs associations, the police. If you're involving all first responders, get everybody at the table. And I think you've already kind of done that, is bring everybody to the table. And then it's everyone needs to check their egos. We need to approach this with humility and curiosity and really start with an interview process. And that's what really got us going, is that's what informed us when we started developing what we needed for psychoeducation and what that group looked like. So it's literally interviewing, and they did 30 to 45 minute interviews, Duncan Shields and a gal by the name of Diana Vissers. And they did in-depth interviews about the impact of the job from recruit to retirement. And we picked people new on the job to people that were retired. And that painted a really good picture of what the needs were. So approaching this with that humility, curiosity, doing a gap analysis, ensuring you have all the stakeholders, and then selecting a place where will work, much like Loon Lake, like trying to brainstorm a place of serenity, calmness, healing, and then, yeah, and picking your facilitators like yourself, people that understand our world, understand our language, are not going to be offended, are not going to break down and cry, that they have the capacity to hear our stories and have their own stories. I think that's the beautiful thing about Duncan and Dave, is they share some of their experience. And that's a tricky line when you're a mental health clinician, is how much do you share? And they can't help themselves, but they've become friends with me. And they become friends with a lot of people coming through that program. And I think, you know, when you trauma bonds and when you go through that together, be prepared to create an even bigger family.
Hmm. Yeah, great advice. Thank you.
Look, sadly, I feel that I have to bring this conversation to an end now. Steve, thank you. I'm sending you an enormous virtual hug. And if you're in the room, I'd give you a massive hug.
Love it.
You've taught us so much and been so authentic in your stories and your sharing. And I feel so blessed to have met you and to have met Duncan and to have you essentially as mentors, really, for our program. And, you know, I've been scribbling notes as I've been going here because you've given me more ideas for things that I think we can do. I know that's dangerous, Shannon, but I've done that.
Last thing we need is you to have more ideas.
So really, you know, we're on this journey to establish a program and for emergency service workers in Victoria, and we will do it.
Yes.
So, you know, it is a passion of mine. So anyway, we're on the journey and you're with us, and that's fantastic. Absolutely. So Absolutely. Thank you very much. Thank you.
Yes, it was an honour.
And thank you all of you who are listening to this Emergency Services Foundation Better Together podcast. We aim to provide you with insights about mental health and wellbeing from experts, thought leaders and people on the ground.
And if you want to know more about what we do, or better still, support our work to establish a program like this, please go to esf.com.au and you'll see lots of information there about Tony's Trek too. So thanks for joining us, and thanks once again, Steve and Shannon, for joining me on this program today.